Welcome to the deep dive. You send us the complex stuff you're curious about, and we extract the key knowledge, making it clear and engaging. Mm-hmm. You're here to understand, not get overwhelmed, and that's exactly what we aim to deliver.
Indeed. Our goal is to provide those crucial aha moments, you know, the insights that suddenly make a dense topic click.
Right.
All tailored to what you, our listener, have specifically asked us to explore.
Today, we're tackling a fascinating piece of research that one of you sent our way, a 2015 paper from the Annals of Probability.
Yeah, this looks interesting.
The subject, the nonlinear stochastic heat equation with rough initial conditions. Sounds intense, right?
It is a sophisticated area, definitely. It deals with how heat spreads in unpredictable environments, especially when the starting temperature distribution is, well, far from smooth.
Okay.
Our mission today is to distill the central discoveries of this paper. We're focusing on how the equation behaves, statistically speaking, and how different initial states influence its long-term development.
Okay, so this paper kicks off by laying out the basic form of this equation. What exactly are we looking at when we see nonlinear stochastic heat equation?
Right. At its core, it's describing the change in some quantity. Let's think of it as temperature over time and space.
Okay.
You've got a term for how that quantity changes in time. That's the time derivative.
Mm-hmm.
And another for how it diffuses across space, which involves something called the Laplacian, the second spatial derivative.
The Laplacian, right. That sounds kind of familiar from, like, basic physics heat equations.
Exactly. Think of the Laplacian as capturing how much the quantity at a point differs from its average in the immediate vicinity. It basically drives the smoothing process, heat moving from hot to cold.
Okay, so that's the standard part. Where does the nonlinear and stochastic come in to make things more complex?
Here's where it gets really interesting and much more challenging to analyze.
I bet.
The nonlinear aspect comes from a function, they call it ur, that modifies the diffusion based on the current value of U itself.
So the heat spread changes depending on how hot it is already.
Precisely. The way the heat spreads isn't constant. It depends on the state of the system. Then stochastic refers to the addition of a.
Wow.
That represents space-time white noise. Imagine a constant barrage of completely random fluctuations hitting the system at every single point in space and time.
Whoa. Okay. Constant random jostling.
Yeah. And finally, we have the initial condition, which is just the starting configuration, the temperature map at time zero.
So it's like the diffusion process has a mind of its own, changing based on the temperature, and it's also being constantly hit by random noise. No wonder it's complex.
Exactly.
Now, the paper references a lot of previous work on this.
Mm.
Why is this equation such a big deal in research?
Well, this type of equation pops up in surprisingly diverse fields. The citations you see in the paper, they cover topics like intermittency, probabilistic potential theory, regularity of solutions.
Yep.
It highlights its broad applicability. Understanding how these solutions behave can give us insights into phenomena that show localized bursts of intensity or highly irregular spatial patterns. Think population dynamics, maybe turbulence.
Okay. And there's a specific example mentioned often, the parabolic Anderson model.
Yeah.
What makes that a key point of reference?
Right. The parabolic Anderson model, or PMAM, it's a simplified version where that nonlinear function is just linear. It's basically U proportional to U itself.
Simpler, but still interesting.
Oh, yeah. Even though it's simpler, it still keeps many of the fascinating characteristics like intermittency. It's become a sort of central model for studying these phenomena.
Got it.
But as we're focusing on today, this paper's main goal is really to see how different starting conditions, the initial data, impact the statistical behavior and the long-term evolution of the solutions.
That makes sense.
Okay.
Okay, now, the paper dives into what it calls the challenge of rough initial conditions.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of starting conditions are usually considered, and what makes these rough ones so much harder?
Good question. Standard theories, especially the foundational work by Walsh, usually assume initial conditions that are relatively well-behaved.
Like what?
Things like temperature profiles that are bounded, you know, don't go to infinity, and are measurable, maybe even continuous. Think of a smoothly varying initial temperature map.
Okay, the easy cases.
The relatively easy, yes. But in many real-world scenarios, the initial state might be much more erratic, maybe highly concentrated in very small regions, or with abrupt jumps. These are what we mean by rough initial conditions.
Like maybe all the initial heat is concentrated, just a single point? Or along a line?
Precisely. This paper specifically looks at cases where the initial condition is a positive Borel measure. That mathematical object allows for these very concentrated starting points.
And why is that harder?
Well, the difficulty arises because these irregularities right at the beginning can lead to much more complex and frankly unpredictable behavior as time evolves. The initial roughness can persist or even amplify. The paper even mentions a technical condition, 1.2, involving convolution with the heat kernel. It basically gives a mathematical way to measure how spread out the initial condition needs to be for some of the standard theories to even apply.
And the paper points out that when these starting conditions are rough, even defining what we mean by a solution gets tricky.
Exactly. When the initial data isn't a nice smooth function, the usual way we define a solution to a partial differential equation, it might just break down, doesn't work.
So what do researchers do?
They've had to come up with alternative ways. For instance, Bertini and Cancrini developed specific definitions just for the parabolic Anderson model, sometimes involving smoothing out the noise term a bit.
Okay.
Others, like Kanis and Koshimidasan, constructed what are called weak solutions. These exist in a more probabilistic sense, defined through certain mathematical averages rather than point-wise.
A different kind of solution.
Yeah. And it's worth noting, some earlier studies even required the initial heat to be contained within a limited region of space, what mathematicians call compact support.
So, trapped in a box initially.
Pretty much. This paper aims to relax some of those limitations on the initial state, allowing for rougher things and things that aren't necessarily confined.
Okay, so rough starts mean new definitions, new challenges. Now, the paper then discusses intermittency. That sounds like something that flickers on and off. Is that the general idea?
That's actually a helpful intuitive picture. In this mathematical context, intermittency refers to a specific kind of behavior in the statistical properties of the solution. Think about its average value, the average of its square, cube, and so on. These are called moments.
Okay. Statistical measures.
Exactly. Intermittency relates to how quickly these moments grow over time. The paper uses things called upper and lower Lyapunov exponents, MPUM and underlyum, to quantify this growth rate for the pth moment.
And intermittency happens when these growth rates follow a particular pattern, like growing faster and faster.
Precisely. Following work by Bertini and Cancrini, the paper defines intermittency when these Lyapunov exponents exist and satisfy a specific increasing inequality, M1, ML2, ML3, and so on. Basically, higher moments grow disproportionately faster.
Okay. And there's another definition, too. Full intermittency.
Yeah, Carmona and Molkanov have a related idea. They focus on the smallest moment P for which the exponent enthalpy comes positive. They define full intermittency as occurring when this happens even for the second moment, when P2.
So mathematically, it's about these growth rates.
Yeah.
But what does it look like? What are these high peaks on small islands the paper mentions?
That's the physical picture. Imagine looking at the temperature profile across space at a given moment in time.
Yeah.
In an intermittent system, you'll find that for most locations, the temperature is very close to zero. Practically nothing there.
Right.
However, in small, scattered regions, these islands, you'll encounter very high, sharp spikes in temperature. Huge values concentrated in tiny areas.
Yeah, I see, like hot spots.
Exactly. These peaks might appear and disappear, move around over time. The mathematical property of intermittency describes how these rare extreme events actually dominate the overall statistical behavior of the system. They drive those fast-growing moments.
Okay, that makes sense.
And this has been a major focus of research for the parabolic Anderson model, both in discrete space, like on a grid, and in continuous space, like we're discussing.
That creates a really clear picture, very different from smooth diffusion. Now, the discussion shifts to growth indices. If we have these localized peaks, where are they likely to be found as time goes on?
Right. So if the initial temperature isn't uniform everywhere, maybe it's concentrated near the center and fades out far away, we want to know how these intense peaks propagate. Where do they spread?
Makes sense.
Konis and Koshnevisan introduced lower and upper exponential growth indices to capture this spatial spread. These indices essentially tell you about the boundary of the region in space where you're most likely to find these significant peaks at a given time.
So if these indices are equal to, say, up B, does that mean the peaks are mostly contained within a region that grows linearly with time? Something like up B?
That's the basic intuition, yeah. If the lower and upper indices match, it suggests a pretty well-defined speed lip at which the front of these high peaks expands outwards.
Okay.
Kochanis and Koshnevisan had some initial findings for the Anderson model, but often for specific cases, like non-negative initial data that was localized in space, compact support, they provided some bounds on up B.
And this paper tries to improve on that.
Exactly. This paper aims to refine those results and broaden them to more general situations.
Which brings us to the novel approach this paper takes, involving weaker conditions on the initial data. How does that allow them to make progress?
This is a key contribution, definitely. Instead of restricting the initial data to be, say, bounded or confined to a limited region, they consider a much larger class of initial measures, though. They need to satisfy a condition related to how quickly they decay exponentially as you move away from the origin.
Okay, a technical condition.
Yeah, it's written as AREX2DX plus SO for all positive A. They call this class of measures MHR.
MHR. What's the significance of this particular condition? What kind of initial states does it allow that were maybe excluded before?
Well, this condition is actually mathematically equivalent to saying something maybe a bit more intuitive. If you smooth out the initial measure using the heat kernel, the fundamental solution of the basic heat equation, the result remains finite everywhere.
Okay.
Importantly, this MHR condition allows for initial conditions that are highly concentrated, like our earlier example, a point source of heat represented by the Dirac delta function that fits in MHR.
So point sources are allowed now. What about things even rougher?
Ah, good question. The paper also shows there's a limit. Proposition 2.11 proves you can't go much rougher than a measure. For instance, something like the derivative of the Dirac delta function. That's too rough. You don't get a standard probabilistic solution then, at least not in the way they define it.
So measures are okay, even spiky ones, but derivatives of measures are out.
Pretty much. On the other hand, this condition does permit initial data that can actually grow exponentially as you move away from the origin.
Really? Even grow?
Yeah, but that growth has to be slower than a Gaussian function. For example, something like EXP, where P is strictly between 0 and 2. That can be okay. So it's a significantly more inclusive set of starting conditions than often assumed.
Okay, so it's a more welcoming club for initial states, as long as they're not too wild. Now, how does the paper then go about analyzing the moments of the solution under these more general conditions?
Right. So with these MHR initial conditions, the paper derives estimates for the expected value of UETXP, the PT moment, specifically for even integers PU2.
Why even integers?
That often simplifies calculations involving the noise term, technically. These moments help us quantify the typical size and the fluctuations, the variability of the solution.
And they get actual formulas sometimes.
Yes. For the specific case of the parabolic Anderson model, the linear case, they managed to obtain an explicit exact formula for the second moment, EUTTATT.
That's quite neat. And they look at specific examples, like constant initial temperature and the Dirac delta.
Exactly. For those specific initial conditions and a slightly more general nonlinearity, or a 2x2 plus U2, they derive explicit formulas for the two-point correlation functions.
The correlation function, that tells you how related the solution is at two different points.
Yeah, UTXO. It measures the statistical dependence between the solution at TX and XE. They compare their formulas with earlier integral forms derived by Bertini and Cancrini, and actually point out some important corrections needed in that prior work.
Okay. Finding corrections.
And interestingly, for the Dirac delta initial data and the second moment, P2, their formula matches results obtained by Borodin and Corwin.
Oh.
Yeah, Borodin and Corwin used completely different mathematical techniques based on something called the KPZ equation and integrable probability. So getting the same answer is a really nice confirmation of their methods.
Different paths, same destination. Cool. Now, the paper mentions a technical insight involving Picard iteration and avoiding Grönwald's lemma. That sounds like deep math machinery. What's the key idea there, basically?
Okay, yeah, let's try to simplify. The standard way to prove that solutions to these kinds of equations exist often involves an iterative process, building the solutions step by step.
Right.
And often you use a mathematical tool called Grönwald's lemma to control how quickly things can grow during that process, ensuring it doesn't blow up. It gives you a bound, but sometimes not a very tight one.
Okay, Grönwald gives a safety net.
Kind of.
Mm-hmm.
This paper takes a different approach with the iteration method called Picard iteration. The key innovation is that they maintain very precise control over the statistical moments, the averages of the solution approximations at each step of the iteration.
Tighter control at each step.
Exactly. By doing this, they can avoid relying on the more general, sometimes looser bounds provided by Grönwald's lemma. This finer level of control is actually what allows them to derive that explicit formula for the second moment in the Anderson model. and also get more precise bounds for the moments, even with general non-linearities.
So avoiding Grandwall lets them be more exact.
In a sense, yes. It allows for sharper estimates.
And this tighter control also leads to a better understanding of those growth indices we discussed earlier, the Lyrid thing.
Precisely, because they have a more accurate picture of how the moments behave, especially their spatial dependence derived from the iteration.
Mm-hmm.
They can also refine the bounds on those exponential growth indices. They get upper bounds for general nonlinearities. And importantly, for the parabolic Anderson model, linear with initial conditions that are non-negative measures with compact support.
The localized ones.
Right. For those, they prove that the lower and upper indices for the second moment and due out to 2 are actually equal.
They nail it down exactly.
For P2, yes, they both equal L2. And they extend this result to a broader class of initial conditions in MHR, not just compactly supported ones.
Wow. What's the implication of that?
The implication is pretty significant. It means that initial conditions that decay quickly enough as you move away from the origin specifically, faster than E, behave essentially the same way as those that are strictly confined to a limited region, compact support, when it comes to how these high-intensity peaks propagate outwards.
So fast decay is almost as good as being trapped in a box for this property.
In terms of the speed of peak propagation, yes. It suggests a kind of universality. The fine details far away don't matter if the decay is fast enough.
That's really interesting. Okay, the paper also gives us a quick roadmap of its structure. Standard stuff.
Pretty standard for a math paper, yeah. Section 2 presents all the main results, the theorems, corollaries. Then, sections 3 and 4 contain the heavy lifting, the detailed mathematical proofs that rigorously establish those results.
Got it. So let's dive into some of these key results, starting with theorem 2.4. It seems to cover a lot. Existence, yeah. Uniqueness, moments. What are the core takeaways from this central theorem?
Okay, theorem 2.4, it's really the cornerstone. Under the main assumptions, the nonlinearity is reasonably well-behaved, Lipschitz continuous, and the initial condition belongs to that broader class MHR we talked about.
Right.
The theorem first guarantees that a unique probabilistic solution, a random field, UTX, actually exists.
Good start. A solution exists and it's the only one.
Yes. It also establishes that this solution is well-behaved statistically. Specifically, it's LP continuous, meaning its average properties change smoothly over time and space.
Okay.
Crucially, the theorem provides upper bounds on the even-numbered moments, UTXP for PO2. These bounds are given in terms of properties of the initial data, quantified by something called JA, and some rather complicated integral kernels, K and H. These kernels capture the influence of the noise and the nonlinearity over time.
So bounds on how big the solution can get, on average.
Exactly. And as we mentioned, it gives an explicit formula for the second moment, when P2. Furthermore, it provides an upper bound on the two-point correlation function, UT, XU, Y, involving a specific integral they call I.
So bounds on moments and correlations. What about lower bounds?
Good point. If the nonlinearity satisfies an additional condition, basically, if it doesn't grow too slowly, condition 2.13, then the theorem also provides corresponding lower bounds for the second moment and the two-point correlation equations 2.23, 2.24.
So you can bracket the moments from above and below?
Under certain conditions, yes. Finally, for that specific tractable form of nonlinearity, right equals is a 2 plus U2, it gives exact formulas for these second moments and correlations, equations 2.25, 2.26. It's a very comprehensive result, packing a lot in.
That is a lot packed into one theorem. Okay, the paper then looks at what happens with specific initial conditions and their implications. Let's start with constant initial data, being Lebesgue measure. What does the paper tell us there?
Right, so this is corollary 2.5. In the scenario where the initial temperature is uniform across all space, and for that quasi-linear nonlinearity where we're 2 plus U plus U2, the paper gives explicit formulas for the two-point correlation function, equation 2.27, and the second moment, or UTXE2, equation 2.28.
And this connects to previous work.
Yes. Notably, as we touched on earlier, for the purely linear case, where wei u meaning 0 in their formula, their result for the second moment aligns with the one derived by Bertini and Cancrini, but with the correction they identified in the earlier work, remark 2.6.
Okay, so it confirms and corrects. What about the other extreme, the highly localized Dirac delta initial condition?
Yes.
That's corollary 2.8.
Yeah.
When the initial condition is the Dirac delta function representing that single point source of heat at the origin, the paper again provides explicit formulas.
For the same things.
Yes. For the two-point correlation function UT, XUTY, equation 2.30, and the second moment UT by 2, equation 2.31, again under that same quasi-linear nonlinearity, X will 2 or 2, 2.
And consistency again. And again, for the linear case, their results are consistent with previous findings by Bertini and Cancrini, remark 2.9. It all ties together nicely.
The paper also briefly mentions higher moments for these specific initial conditions in examples 2.7 and 2.0. What's the key takeaway there? Just consistency.
Pretty much. These examples illustrate the bounds they obtain for higher order moments, like P4P, P6, in the cases of constant and Dirac delta initial data. The important point is that these bounds derived from their general theorem 2.4 are shown to be consistent with other known results or specific calculations in the field. It just adds further support to their framework.
Okay, and we discussed this earlier, but it seems important enough to emphasize again. Proposition 2.01 talks about the impossibility for rougher initial data. What's the crucial message there?
Right. This proposition establishes a fundamental limitation. It shows that if the initial condition is even more irregular, more spiky, than a measured Delver, their example is the mathematical derivative of the Dirac delta function, then a standard random field solution to the stochastic heat equation with linear nonlinearity simply does not exist. It breaks.
So there's a definite edge. You can be rough, like a measure, but not too rough.
Exactly. It highlights just how sensitive the equation's well-posedness is to the initial state's regularity. It underscores the significance of that MHR condition as a kind of boundary for existence of these nice probabilistic solutions.
Okay, super important boundary condition. Finally, let's delve into theorem 2.12 on growth indices. What are the main conclusions we should draw from this one? This is about where the peaks go.
Yes. Theorem 2.12 offers significant generalizations and improvements to earlier work on how those high-intensity peaks spread spatially.
Okay, what does it say?
Part 1 provides a lower bound on the growth index if the nonlinearity satisfies a certain lower growth condition related to Fuser offless U. Interestingly, it also shows that if that parameter from the nonlinearity is non-zero, the growth indices can become infinite.
Infinite. Peaks spread instantly.
Not quite instantly, but arbitrarily fast growth rates are possible, suggesting the framework of finite speed propagation might break down if geo is not zero.
Okay. What about upper bounds?
Part 2 gives upper bounds on imbolism for even values of p, provided the nonlinearity satisfies an upper growth condition, and the initial data decays sufficiently fast exponentially, belonging to a class Medgr. They give specific bounds depending on L and Gr.
So upper and lower bounds now.
Under different conditions, yes. And part 3 is where they nail down the exact values. For that quasi-linear nonlinearity plus U of C and initial data with appropriate exponential decay related to Wheel U, they find the exact values of E of U to Fus, specifically E of U if it's fast enough, the same bunch we heard about before. Exactly. So overall, this theorem expands on previous results by handling more general initial conditions, not just compact support, providing both upper and lower bounds, proving the precise transition speed for the parabolic Anderson model, and covering cases where the nonlinearity doesn't necessarily vanish at zero, zero. It's a much more complete picture of peak propagation.
That sounds like a major step forward in understanding those growth indices. And the paper provides examples like delta and exponential initial data to show these results in action.
Correct. Example 2.13 shows how their general theorem recovers the previously known bounds on growth indices, specifically for the Dirac delta initial data. And Proposition 2.14 looks at exponentially decaying initial data, showing that the predicted exact transition for Ney really does occur as their upper bounds suggest, confirming the sharpness of their results.
Wow. Okay. That was a truly deep dive. So to try and bring it all together, what are the absolute core insights we should take away from this exploration into the stochastic heat equation with these rough initial conditions?
I think the main thing is how this paper significantly advances our understanding by expanding the range of initial conditions we can handle. Yeah. It really lets us analyze the behavior of the stochastic heat equation more broadly.
Right.
And it underscores the critical role that the initial state, how rough it is, how fast it decays, plays in determining the statistical properties of the solution down the line, especially its moments and the way those intermittency peaks spread out.
Yeah, and we saw that clear boundary measures okay, but rougher things break the model.
Exactly. There's a fundamental limit to how irregular the initial conditions can be for these kinds of meaningful probabilistic solutions to even exist.
And there were definitely some surprising aha moments for me, like that finding that initial conditions decaying quickly enough spatially can essentially mimic the behavior of strictly localized initial states, at least in terms of how the peaks spread. That felt counterintuitive, but really powerful.
It is powerful, yeah. It suggests a certain robustness or universality. And technically, the paper's innovative use of Picard iteration with that tight moment control proved really effective. It wasn't just about proving existence, it gave them the tools to get explicit results and sharper bounds than maybe previous methods allowed.
So this deep dive has hopefully given us, and you listening, a shortcut to grasping the essential findings of a pretty complex piece of research. It reveals this intricate interplay between the starting roughness, the nonlinear diffusion, and that constant random noise in shaping how these systems evolve.
Indeed. It really highlights the delicate balance between, you know, deterministic spreading and random fluctuations when we're dealing with these kinds of complex phenomena.
So for you, the listener, maybe consider this. Many real-world systems, perhaps in finance or biology or physics, maybe the spread of information or populations can be modeled by equations with similar features. Randomness, nonlinear interactions, and often, let's face it, pretty messy starting conditions.
Mm-hmm.
What does our exploration of this specific equation and its sensitivity to those rough initial states and how the peaks propagate suggest about our ability to predict and maybe even control such complex systems in your own field of interest? Certainly something to think about.
Absolutely. And if you find yourself pondering these questions further, or if you have other intricate research papers, maybe something you're grappling with that you'd like us to unpack in a future deep dive, please don't hesitate to send it our way. That's what we're here for.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Until our next exploration, keep those curious minds engaged.